Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by ACT, whose upcoming season includes Tom Stoppard, Stephen Sondheim, and the grand opening of the all-new Strand Theater in downtown San Francisco. Information at act-sf/join.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, prolific author William T. Volman is based in Sacramento, and he's written about many subjects, including cross-dressing, war violence, the settlement of North America, prostitution, and Copernicus, among many other topics. In his new short story collection, he takes readers to diverse settings, including Japan, the Balkans, Italy, South America, and Mexico, while delving into themes of mortality, the afterlife, and the supernatural. He'll join us in studio for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. William T. Volman is a Sacramento-based novelist, journalist, war correspondent, short story writer, and essayist who won the National Book Award for Fiction for the 2005 novel Europe Central. His first fiction since then is his new collection of 32 stories, a globe-spanning book about love, loss, and death, not to mention a geisha, a vampire, the war in the former Yugoslavia, and a haunted house, among many other things. Last Stories and Other Stories, a work of over 600 pages, is his 22nd book. He's a recipient of the Strauss Living Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Whiting Writers Award, and the Penn Center USA West Fiction Award, and joins us in studio for the second hour. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Michael.
In fact, you've been on the program before, but this is the first time I get to see you in the flesh, and pleased to have you here. I want to talk first with you, because we've right around the celebration, the memorialization, whatever one wants to call it, the noting of the 20-year anniversary of the war in Yugoslavia, and your new book begins with the siege of Sarajevo, and it not only takes us back to that siege and the shelling, in fact, that is really sort of pervasive in that first story, but also 20 years later. Now, as I understand it, this writing came out of your finding a notebook going back to 1992 and that you used for Rising Up and Rising Down?
That's right. I try to close out my old notebooks over time. I just draw an X through a page once everything's been entered in my computer. And I was getting ready to throw out this notebook, and then I saw, you know, there are some interesting passages here, and I started remembering how scary it was. And I thought, you know, I'd really like to do something with this, and I'd like to see Sarajevo again. After all these years, I had a chance to go over there for my French publisher, and then I went back a little bit after that, and I was quite saddened to see how there were still big shell holes in the buildings. It seemed like the city had recovered much less than I would have expected. A lot of poverty. And I talked to people a little bit about some of the events, and some of them were extremely closed. They didn't want to talk about it at all. And others would sort of open up to me when they heard that I had been there, however briefly, during the siege. It was a strange bond to have.
Well, you make the shelling palpable in the writing. I mean, it feels very scary, and there's a story early on about crossing a young couple crossing a bridge, a kind of Romeo and Juliet of Sarajevo, as they were called, and it gets international attention, and they were both killed. What struck me about that story, and it was very moving in many ways, and what I came away with particularly was, I mean, they were of different backgrounds, but you know, people couldn't remember who was Serbian, who was Muslim, who was Croatian, and that continues to this day, doesn't it?
That's right. There are so many different possibilities for the way that people could get together, these different ethnicities, and it never used to really matter.
Under Tito, it didn't matter at all, did it really?
That's right. Yeah. I remember in 94 one time, I was coming into ex-Yugoslavia, and I asked somebody, so how is it that you guys do it? You know, you've gotten along so well, and then suddenly you're cutting your neighbor's throats. What's the procedure? And the guy said, well, it's very simple. Some outside agitators come into a little town, and they kill first a Serb, then a Croat, then a Muslim. And if nothing happens, they wait a while, and then they go back to step one. That's all you need to do.
That sounds like a Milosevic tactic, though, doesn't
yeah.
it? This is a book that really has to do, as you have said and as you say early on, with kind of supernatural and eternal consciousness possibilities. Why not expect that? A ghost told me so, you say at one point early on in the book. And even things like remembering before birth. I think it was Samuel Beckett who said he remembered being in the womb, but most of us don't seem very knowledgeable about the idea of before birth, or if we do, it takes a certain kind of leap of faith. Have you always been kind of interested in this area? Because people associate with so many, such a vast expanse of interests and polymath kind of interests at that, but haunted and supernatural and ghosts and eternal life.
Well, you know, Michael, I mean, no matter how I try to understand it, the whole thing baffles me. There's an eternity before us, an eternity after us, as far as we know, and then there's consciousness. And if consciousness is accidental, some biochemical artifact, that seems preposterous. And it seems equally preposterous that we were put here for some reason, and this brief span of life that we have can make such an incredible difference to our postmortem existence. I can't figure it out, and maybe that's how death is. You look at it, you try to project your own consciousness on it, and what you get back is nothing. Because death is nothing. So any story about death is going to be some kind of failure. All you can do is personify it.
All you can do is let your imagination loose. I was reading something you talked about in The Atlantic about Hassan the assassin, figure in the 11th or 12th century, who said nothing is true, all is permissible. And I mean, that sounds horrible, and he was a killer, but you said that should apply to the imagination.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense for these stories. I don't have to worry about whether there are really vampires or if there's eternal consciousness within the skeleton or whatever. But I might as well play with it and see what happens.
Well, vampires are very in vogue these days, so you've got that advantage too. When you talked about making a difference, though, I was struck by the journalist figure, maybe alter ego or whatever he is, in this early Siege chapter, where he talks about wanting to make a difference. He wants to write things down. He wants to, in other words, feel that he can get people to learn from what he learns, that personifies in many ways the role of the writer, and that he can make a difference, can bring people agency.
I think that often young people go into a career in medicine or law enforcement or social work or journalism or the military, even thinking that somehow they're going to do their might to bring about more good in the world. And it's not impossible, but you have to lower your expectations. And I think Gandhi was right when he said you have to scrupulously eschew the desire for results. I work very, very hard, you know, when I go into a war zone to try to understand what is going on there and try to bring that back to others. But I know that often, through no fault of mine, the story will get killed or it'll get shortened or there will be some other story that says something different, and there's very little that I can do. That doesn't let me off the hook. I have to keep trying.
So this is not your last book then, even though
no.
you say so.
It seemed like a good creepy title for some ghost stories.
And the title, by the way, is Last Stories and Other Stories by William Volman, who is National Book Award winner and who is here with us in studio for this hour, and we'll certainly invite your calls. I noticed recently that Maxine Hong Kingston received the National Humanities Medal, and she writes about ghosts too, but she means ghosts in terms of those of us among the living. I mean, you're getting at that too in your work here, aren't you?
I think, yeah, there are many ways to see ghosts. I mean, one way is sort of a projection of our grief and loss when someone whom we care for is gone. And another is sort of what happens as memory mutates. These three ex-Yugoslavian stories you were talking about deal with the decay of memory about this inter-ethnic couple.
Excuse me, early on you say the past is another country, like Hartley. You have to explore it and you have to find out what the language is there, don't you?
I think so. It seems that way to me in when I'm writing my historical fiction. And the farther back you go in the past, the more alien it is.
And the more your memory doesn't necessarily serve you.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Alas. you lost a couple of friends in Yugoslavia. Yeah.
Yes, I did. We were in Mostar trying to go back to Sarajevo a couple of years after the siege. And we were crossing a dam from west to east Mostar. And it was never clear to me whether my friends were killed by snipers or by some kind of a mine trap. They died, quite horribly.
Survivor guilt? Is it real?
Sure, of course. The more people you see die, the easier it gets, or the more cold or numb you get, as a woman in Sarajevo told me. She was losing, someone she knew almost every week. And after a while you think, all right, yeah, of course I'm a survivor. Of course I'm guilty. And I'll always be a little guilty. And in the meantime, let's get on with my life.
You also lost a sister at a young age.
Yeah, that was actually harder. I was younger and...
She was in your...
In my care, yeah. I was 9 and she was 6. We were out swimming and I was supposed to be keeping an eye on her. And I was drawing some diagram in the sand or something or other. And just suddenly I looked up and she was gone and I didn't know where she had gone. I definitely failed her there. Although my father said there's plenty of blame to go around, but I have to take my share.
Again, we're talking to William Volman. Last Stories and Other Stories is his new book. And you are also a painter, a visual artist, do woodcuts, photos, do all whole range of things. I noticed you've given credit to Gauguin, a Native American artist, chief influences in your own work. And you have that studio in Sacramento in not the best part of town, right? What's more important to you, doing that kind of work or writing fiction or writing journalism, or can't you even establish a hierarchy?
I like to do it all. Sometimes I'm doing more of one thing than the other. When I was heavily into the war journalism for Rising Up and Rising Down, I would find that if I took a camera with me and I could look at the pictures months or even years later, I would see things that I hadn't seen at the time. The camera would teach me something. Oh, look at this person's expression. I didn't realize how desperate this person is. Look at this sign in the background that is really revealing. And so I love the camera. There's only so much that I can do at any one time. If I'm interviewing someone, I'm writing down the words and taking a couple pictures. But I like to have that stuff all together. And I feel the same about my visual art. It can express things that complement the words.
You love other kinds of shooting, too. You love guns.
I do, yeah. I love my Israeli Military Industries Desert Eagle 50 caliber. And last year, my daughter was 14. I took her out shooting for the first time. It was 108 degrees, and she got a bullseye. So I was very proud of her.
Uh-huh. But you think the Second Amendment is a great thing, I think I read once. You've extolled it.
I think that whatever side of that you come down on, you have to accept a certain price. You leave people the freedom to have firearms, and inevitably some of them are going to misuse it and kill others. You take the firearms away and you run the risk that someday, maybe not now, but later, we can have a tyrannical government.
Getting back to writing fiction for a moment, if we could. Again, we're talking to Bill Volman, author of Last Stories and Other Stories. My listeners know I'm a major fan of Raymond Carver's and have been for many years, and he was identified with specific writers, Richard Ford and Tobias Wolff. You've been identified with specific writers. David Foster Wallace, Jonathan Franzen, who I know is a friend of yours, Richard Powers. And there was all this ballyhoo that you were the heirs to Pynchon and Barth and so forth. I mean, does that kind of coterie or association make sense to you? I know you're all Midwest guys, but...
Well, Dave and John and I, yeah, we're all roughly the same age, and we were writing long books. yeah, and I have been friends with both of them. I haven't seen John in a number of years. I'd be happy to see him again. And of course, I'm not likely to talk to Dave again except by Ouija board.
Well, but how much do you honor the memory of David Foster Wallace?
I thought that he was an extremely talented person who never completely realized his talent. I think that in...
Because he's always so self-abasing, you mean, or self-flagellating,
yes.
Yeah.
I think in some of his short stories, that's where you see... his finest work. In Girl with Curious Hair, there are some that I really, really like. What a pity that that he suffered so much.
You don't drive or use the internet?
That's right, yeah.
How'd you get here today?
I had a very sweet and beautiful media escort named Dolores who brought me here.
Well, speaking of Dolores, what a segue. I mean, this has been something that's gotten a great deal of attention. You're transgressing and calling yourself Dolores. What was the impetus for that?
Well, I just thought, Michael, you know, if I can go to Yemen and meet young men who identify with Al-Qaeda and try to understand their point of view, then how can I not really try harder to understand the female point of view, whatever that is? And I was writing a book about no theater called Kissing the Mask, in which femininity is performed by men, old men. I started talking to geishas and watched them perform the femininity they had been born into but trained themselves into some higher or lower or more intense escalation of. And I thought, you know, I wonder what this all means. I wonder, can I perform femininity too? To what extent is it a performance? And I have some friends who are T girls, you know, trans women. And I'm thinking, okay, now, are they women in a different way than the G girls are, the genetic girls? You
come
know,
to any conclusion?
Well, one thing I found was that when I was blundering around, you know, with my breast forms and high heels at night, guys were roaring by in cars yelling things. I thought, oh, yeah, I get it. I understand now why some women really don't like to go out at night. I feel sort of vulnerable, a little bit humiliated. And, you know, I'd understood it, but I'd never felt it.
Well, you know, Dustin Hoffman performed as Tootsie.
Oh, I remember that one, yeah.
Well, he wrote something that was actually rather eloquent in its own way and created a lot of the likes on Facebook that people check off when they like something, and a lot of women were certainly speaking exuberantly and positively about this. What he said was he never realized how invisible he was. He'd walk down the street, he looked like an older woman, or certainly not a woman, you know, who was going to be a lightning rod because she's attractive. He wasn't an attractive woman. And realized that, you know, when women reach a certain stage, they're not necessarily looked at. I mean, it's probably true for men as well, but much more for women.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's probably more fear and sadness in a lot of the women whom I know about getting old. Because, you know, as a man, I never thought twice about looking good. I can hardly be bothered to comb my hair. So what do I care about? A few more wrinkles or whatever. But when Dolores wanted to look good, and then I would take a picture of her and she would put her glasses back on and see how ugly she looked. Poor girl, you know, it was quite discouraging for her.
And the mascara turned out to be pretty tough, huh?
Yeah, that's right for me anyway.
To talk about your career as being colorful is to realize how inadequate the English language is. I mean, you talked about, for example, talking to Al-Qaeda members in Yemen. You've talked to neo-Nazis. I know the Dolores stuff has brought you maybe even more stuff, let's call it, than those things did because of the provocative nature of sort of shifting genders that way. But I just want listeners to know, you nearly froze to death up in the Arctic, hired and bought a sex slave to essentially get her out of sex slavery in Thailand. You live with homeless people. We talked about that, in fact, here on Forum. You went over to the border to study poverty, Mexican border. We also talked with you about train hopping. I mean, all of these things suggest just either an adventurous spirit or a polymath kind of consciousness. And a lot of people would say, why does he do all these things? I mean, you must ask yourself that. Material?
I always feel that that my mind, one person's mind, is so limited. And I want to see as much as I can. I remember being with my friend Steve on the back of a grainer car. We are riding a freight train up through the Feather River Canyon. And it was very dark, but the stars were getting bigger and brighter and colder, everything colder. So we went up and I thought, I really feel like I'm coming out into the universe right now. And I'm in this place which is so far beyond my petty understanding and concerns, and I just want to grow and enlarge myself as much as I can and see as much as I can, see the stars and see the sun come up and meet every different kind of person I can.
You had no idea that you were being profiled by the FBI as possibly being the Unabomber?
No, I was shocked.
When you look back on that, I mean, just that strange revelation to see that they had actually pinpointed you as a potential suspect. What do you make of it now in retrospect?
Well, I have to thank them that they never did haul me into some black prison. It could have been a lot worse. And the whole thing made me a little money. I got to sell the story. But it was disconcerting. And maybe the strangest aspect of it was to see that part of their grounds for suspicion was a novel I had written about Iroquois in Canada back in the 1600s before there was a U.S., and that somehow this meant that I might be subversive or something of the sort because I didn't completely side with the Jesuit missionaries. I thought it was a very interesting exercise in literary criticism on their part, and I would love to meet whoever it was who wrote this and just have a drink with him and try to understand how he thinks, because to me it seems preposterous, but what do I know?
See, there's your curiosity. I mean, it really works for you. You want to learn all these things or find out about them. Somebody who references to me sent me a quote that said, I there's nothing for me to learn from the missionaries and there's everything for me to learn from the natives. I mean, sort of gleaning from what you were saying, that little axiom. And axioms are an important part of this new book of Bill Volman's. Again, it's called Last Stories and Other Stories. I'm going to invite you, our listeners, to participate in this program if you'd like to talk with William Volman, if you have questions or comments, if you'd like to just join the conversation. Please feel free to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. We do, again, cordially invite you to participate in the program, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with William Volman, and you are certainly welcome to join us. William Volman is the author of a new book called Last Stories and Other Stories. He's also the author of Europe Central, which won the National Book Award. And I'm going to ask him to read, actually, from Last Stories and Other Stories. This is from that first story that I mentioned and alluded to.
Yeah, maybe I'll read the first two paragraphs of Listening to the Shells.
Good.
In the dimming living room, they were drinking slivovitz and water out of fine crystal glasses, and everyone was laughing and smoking American cigarettes until a shell fell 25 meters away. The women jumped. Another shell fell slightly closer, and the women screamed. Then the people sat silently smoking in the last light, their smoke nearly the same color as the drinking glasses, and presently began to laugh again, leaning over their hands or spreading their fingers. They stubbed out their cigarettes in crystal ashtrays, and the poet who loved Vesna even suspected that finally he had found life. But Enko, the militiaman, sat glaring. Now it was dark, with echoes of the last light fading from the bubbles of mineral water just within the glasses and from the women's pale blouses, and they sat in silence, listening to the shells. When a shell approaches closely, you may well hear a hiss before it strikes. Once it does, you will be deafened for a minute or two, during which time you are not good for much except to wait for another shell. Meanwhile, you see what they call the big light. After that, you can hear the screams of children.
That's really vivid writing. I mean, it's the kind of war writing we associate with, and just in terms of detail and the senses and so forth. And frankly, I associate with Mailer or Hemingway. I mean, high praise deserved because you really bring the war home into your prose. Also struck, well, let's talk about those characters, Enko and Vesna, because they're sort of in their own way brilliantly realized characters, and the poet. I mean, these are characters presumably you had some prototypes for in your own experiences in Yugoslavia.
They're composites. Yeah. But, yeah, I was never lucky enough to be in the position of my protagonist to have this bunch of jolly, lively friends to hang out with. I was stuck mostly in a youth hostel at the front line. It was just this horrible, horrible place. And it was not quite this party atmosphere. But I've gotten to know different people from ex-Yugoslavia over the years. And so it was actually a fun challenge to try to create those particular characters.
Well, all that talk also about Slavic women or Yugoslavian women, the poet takes a lot of this credit for this, too. You have, I suppose, let's talk about your interest in women. I mean, becoming Dolores, but also having women often as subjects of your art, your visual art. I mean, there's no way to say this except directly. You paint a lot of vaginas.
Well, it's what we all came from. And maybe the perfect death will involve going back to one. You can always hope.
Back to the womb.
That's right.
Also, you use the word goddesses for some of the women. You have a lot of sex workers and women that you have in your life, either as models or in one form or the other. I think that was a word that Charlie Sheen used, too. No analogies implied here. But and you're married to an oncologist, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, women play, it's safe to say, a very premier role in your life and your consciousness and who you are?
They do. And when I was writing a lot about street prostitutes, I really felt that they somehow would take away the pain of a lot of their male clients. Sometimes that pain would just be transferred to them. They couldn't necessarily get rid of it themselves. It was a brave and kind of sacred thing that they did.
This goes back to a lot of mythic roles and folkloric roles and even cultural roles for prostitutes. Yeah,
I think so.
Then you've got a geisha in your new collection who is transmogrified into, let's talk about that. I mean, what was the impetus behind that?
To me, it's very interesting to go to Kyoto and meet these high-ranking geishas. The apprentice geishas are called maikos, and they are very, very young and beautiful and wear the most beautiful costume. When they complete their apprenticeship, the costume becomes plainer, And it's a sign that they are now more sober and mature. But oftentimes, of course, people most want to see the Mycos. They are really spectacular. And I thought, I wonder what it must be like for a Myco to know that now she has to change her collar, as they put it. And even though it's a promotion of sorts, it must be very, very sad. So this story was about a young woman who didn't want to change her collar and prayed to Kenon, the goddess of mercy, for permission to stay a Myco as long as possible. So the deal she worked out was...
She becomes a cherry tree.
Right. Most times of the year. And every now and then she can come back as a Myco. So her life is extended. When she's not in this vegetative state, she can age a little bit, but very, very slowly.
Going back to the character of Enko, though, I was struck by that character. You say probably a composite, and I can understand that, but there's a drive in this. I mean, first of all, he wants binoculars, but aside from that, I mean, there's a drive in this guy that just seems to me to be often paramount in many of those who are sort of in the war and not in the war. I mean, you know, he's driven essentially to... It's clear what side he's on, but he's going to take the journalists, take him to the front. And he's honorable, really. I mean, you know, he takes money, but he doesn't use it in ways that are irrelevant to the purpose of helping the journalists see things.
Yeah, in war zones, you can meet a lot of people who are kind of like Enko. They're very, very hard people. They've been wounded. They've been in battle. They've seen people they care for die. And they can be quite pitiless. And of course, they're damaged in many ways. They don't realize how damaged they are. And if they did, it would probably be harmful to their survival. And I often find that when I'm in some kind of dangerous situation, I kind of steel myself and I try not to think about what this is really doing to me. And it's not until I get out of there that I realize, you know, now I'm going to have something else to have nightmares about, and I'm going to have more grief when I think about these poor people suffering. Somebody like Enko is stuck there, and he can't get out of there. And all he can do is become harder.
More hardened, yeah.
Yeah.
And then 20 years later, we meet his kid, and his kid seems to have a lot of that, just in the way he's quickly portrayed for us.
Yeah. It's still kind of a desperate place in some ways.
Invite those of you listening to join us with William Volman. If you are a reader of his, if you have questions or comments for him, this is an opportunity to talk to him directly. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, number for your calls, 866-733-6786. Want to respond to anything you heard so far or join the conversation, we do welcome you. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. A couple of tweets here. A listener wants to know, any chances Mr. Volman will someday have a show of his artwork here in the Bay Area? Absolutely love his use of lines.
Oh, well, that's very nice. And I'm talking to a gallery owner right now, so there may be a show in January.
Another tweet, William T. Volman is a genius. He's on KQED Forum. Love how he thrusts himself in two situations and mixes with people. Got to get his latest.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah, you like those, I'm sure. What writer doesn't? here's an email comment. His explanation of the Second Amendment was concise and accurate. So nice to hear this view on Forum, since most guests hold an opposing view. And another listener writes, Volman telling ghost stories? Volman is himself spooky for his monumental range and creativity. It's weird to think how many fewer books he sold than any number of chick lit or management consulting books. Thanks for having him on the show.
Well, I hope some ghosts will buy my books.
You do have a considerable number of fans out there. And they're mostly literary people, or do they follow kind of along a wide range?
I would say quite a wide range. And I feel very lucky, actually, when I go and give a reading. I like to go out afterward with anyone who wants to come. And it's amazing, you know, that my readers have supported me since 1986. I haven't had a real job in all that time.
You're sold out tonight, I understand, or there's no room for you at City Arts.
That's very nice.
Another listener writes, I understand Mr. Volman has had issues with carpal tunnel, but of course he has. How has he dealt with it?
When my daughter was a little baby, I used to pick her up and carry her around and not type that day. And just using my upper arms instead of my wrists seemed to shake it out of my system.
That's good advice. How'd your daughter and wife respond to Dolores?
They weren't thrilled, but they managed. Lisa, my little girl, I think had fun, maybe shocking the parents of her friends in high school. So it all worked out.
And generally, your wife and your daughter are, shall we say, indulgent, tolerant? I'm not sure what word to use here about.
Yeah, tolerant sounds like a good description.
Ben writes, has your guest felt any pushback from family or friends because of his experiential lifestyle? Or lifestyles.
Sure. When the first chapter of Butterfly Stories appeared in Esquire, I was at my grandfather's house for Christmas. And there were a lot of mournful and angry looks from the relatives. Some people decided they were going to cancel their subscriptions to Esquire. There were, you know, descriptions of unprotected sex with AIDS-infected prostitutes and drug use. So, you know, just family stuff. I couldn't see what the big deal was.
They were pretty upset, I'm sure. You celebrate Christmas?
Sure, I'll celebrate anything.
What about belief that goes with Christmas? Faith, where are you on that?
Well, let's see. I think that if Jesus was divine and if he comes back, the place to look for him is in a homeless camp. I tend to imagine him as a very charismatic, possibly mentally ill, but not necessarily teacher and agitator who I'm sure would be immediately put in prison today.
You read Reza Aslan's book, Zealot? Yeah,
I mean, no.
That's his thesis, basically. It is indeed his thesis. Why do you choose to live in Sacramento? A lot of people have asked you that, I'm sure, and continue to ask you that.
Well, for one thing, space is really cheap. I have a former Mexican restaurant that's my studio. The whole property with the parking lot is 10,000 square feet, and I shudder to think how many millions that would be in San Francisco. And this place is going to be paid off in another year or two. I like the people in Sacramento. They're really friendly, lots of trees. Not too many people read, so I can walk down the street and just people will say, oh, hi, Bill, how are you? It's not a bad life.
You like that anonymity? I mean,
yeah, I do.
Faulkner could walk through Oxford, Mississippi, and they'd say, hi, Bill. You know?
Right.
He liked that. I mean, I'm assuming that, inferring from what you say, you like it too.
I do.
And generally, I mean, do the... The people in Sacramento aren't readers, but, you know, you've had a lot of the spotlight and coverage and, you know, articles that have appeared not only in major magazines but newspapers. I mean, they're many of them familiar with sort of the works and adventures that you've had?
It's hard to say. I let people ask me whatever they want, and I don't mind if they get it wrong. I figure, why not just make things easy for everybody?
They don't know that you were under suspicion as a Unabomber or as the anthrax mailer, too. That was in your FBI file, though, right?
Yeah, that's right. I guess I was an anthrax suspect in part because I was a former Unabomber suspect. It's nice to think of your tax dollars at work.
Let's talk. In fact, you've been very outspoken about incursions of privacy and feeling that maybe we're bordering on a police state. I mean, NSA certainly brought a lot of that home. I mean, is that too harsh to characterize your own sentiments here?
No, I'm quite concerned about the direction in which we're heading. I mean, we've been going in that direction since before September 11th. You know, the war on drugs, the war on child pornography, I'm sure ramped up various bureaucracies, and everyone wants to keep his or her job. And once we decide that certain things are okay in terms of spying on people or suspecting people of this or that, I think those people are not going to unjustify their existences and say, oh, we have no need to do this ever again. It seems as if in the Roman Empire, once torture was introduced, you know, at first it was limited to slaves. And then as time went by, it sort of crept up the ladder. And after a while, they were torturing Roman citizens too. So now that that we have introduced torture, I wonder what's going to happen if the U.S. is still around in 200 or 300 years, what kind of state it will be. But I see very, very little that is good about the internet because of the surveillance and the potential for what soon won't even be called abuse. It'll just be normative spying.
Well, some of your political views have been characterized as libertarian. I don't know if that fits or if that suits you, but the fact of the matter is that you have been also very critical of unregulated coal and nuclear industries. I mean, to what extent should they be regulated?
I think that corporations need to be regulated and taxed. You know, back in Roosevelt's day, there was talk of a 90 to 100% tax on high incomes. I think it's unconscionable that these huge corporations are not getting taxes that could really fund our social programs and fund the regulation of these greed heads who will use any excuse not to do something that might cost an extra cent and save a life. Do I think that, you know, coal mines or nuclear power plants should be shut down tomorrow? No, I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. But I just got back from West Virginia, and every time I go, I see people who are saying, you know, Bill, what are we supposed to do? This is our only hope.
Only means of employment.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah.
And it's not fair to just make them sacrifice.
But they're blowing off top of mountains. I mean, you know, how do you reconcile that?
And mostly it's not them. Mostly it's these absentee companies who come in. They don't need very many miners at all to take the top off a mountain.
Listener wants to know, tweeted us, and you can tweet us. Our handle is at KQED Forum. Do you really have a flamethrower? Really, really? I couldn't finish your science book. Ah.
It would be sort of fun to have a flamethrower, but only the FBI thought that I did.
Let's talk a little, we'll bring the listeners in again, but about style in your work. I read a review of this new book of yours, Last Stories and Other Stories in the New York Times. I thought, I often have this feeling, read the same book that I've read. I mean, I find your sentences compelling and poetic and, you know, sometimes maybe a little overreaching or whatever, but how important just is language to you and your use of language, stylistics, for lack of a better word?
To me, the most important thing is to write a beautiful sentence. And if I write a paragraph of beautiful sentences and then read it over and make sure that it actually says something and then keep tweaking it, then maybe I can do something worthwhile and make a beautiful story. But without attention to style, I would say it would just be a waste of my time.
So how much of it goes into tweaking and editing in terms of your work? Because I imagine a lot of people who realize how prolific you are think you're writing all the time, but of course you're editing as well. Huh?
Well, with a story like Listening for the Shells, the one that we were talking about earlier, I had certain notes in the notebook that were descriptions of sounds and the way windows looked when they were broken from a bullet or whatever. And I couldn't really alter those very much. Those were written at the moment, and they were as accurate as they were going to be. But then when I was creating the characters and the dialogue and trying to figure out where to put this or that description, that's where a lot of the work came in. And I polish my stories and novels as much as I can.
Your work in Harper's, which we discussed about the homeless encampments. Are you still tied to those communities?
Yes. And Safe Ground, the place that I wrote about, is has been trying to find some permanent place to erect cheap solar-powered housing. But, you know, the struggle goes on. It's still illegal in Sacramento to camp in your own backyard for more than one night.
This is a question from June on our website, and it's a question I was prompted to ask as well. Since you got into the minds of Al-Qaeda members, what can you tell us about their mindsets?
Well, many of them have never met Americans, they are as ignorant of us as we are of them. I remember taking one man out for lunch in Yemen, and he told me how he wanted to kill all the Americans he could. I asked him how many he'd met. He said, "Well, you're the first one." And I brought my Quran along. So we were talking about the Quran, and he ended up really liking me. I liked him too. And he said, "Well, Mr. William, now you're excused. You know, I don't want to kill you." And I thought, you know,
all the rest of those Americans, you get a pass.
Right. And I often hear Americans saying similar things about, oh, you know, those horrible Pakistanis, they're all out to get us, or the Afghans, you know, they're all just Talibs. And I feel like if there were only more exchange of views, ideally in childhood, that could make a big difference. And nobody thinks, oh, I'm a bad person, I'm a killer. Everyone is driven into some position as a result of some kind of trauma.
It's demonization that you're really talking about. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that we were talking last hour about Israel and Palestine, and I've said for a number of years now, if there were more of this kind of social intercourse that you're talking about, or more exposure on both sides, like there was at one point, and it's all kind of gone by the wayside now, it would make an extraordinary difference. But how do you get access in the first place to people who are firm in their belief that all Americans are their enemies and you're an American?
Not very hard at all to find those people nowadays, unfortunately.
Didn't you think they were going to hold you hostage or something?
In Yemen, it was a little scary a couple times. People would say, oh, you're an American. You deserve to be killed.
But not only that, hold you for an exchange or something like that, or think that they can get money by holding you.
Sure.
It's very common in that part of the world.
Yeah, you have to take your chances. I was actually more worried about that when I was in Colombia, when journalists were routinely kidnapped.
And a journalist was just abducted earlier today, a CNN journalist in Ukraine.
I'm not surprised. When I was in Sarajevo in 92, it was common for journalists to be targeted. And the reason was, they said, if a journalist is killed, the international community pays more attention. So everybody has some kind of calculus, you know, for who to steal from and who to hold hostage and who to kill. And all you can really do is go about your business.
Let's go about our business and bring another caller on. Jeff, you're on. Hi.
Oh, hi. Yes, I just had a question about William Vollman's alter ego, Dolores.
Yes.
I was wondering, is the name sort of an homage to the French artist Duchamp's alter ego, feminine alter ego, whose name I believe was also Dolores?
Well, actually, the first time that a certain woman friend made me up, she said, you know, you are a big, tall, sort of sad-looking woman, so I think your name should be Dolores. And actually, Dolores is often quite happy, but it is true
it's the root word is dolor, which is sadness.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So
that was your thinking, Bill?
Yeah, that was my thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for the question, Jeff. Good to hear from you. And, you know, some of the details that you come up with, I mean, talking about, for example, the fact that I remember reading about Serbians praising the good fortune of those who die at Easter because they'll ascend more quickly to heaven. The angels are doing Mary. Or in the section that you read from, wearing a bulletproof vest, if you're sweating a lot, there's more of a chance of it not working for you. I mean, there's a prodigious amount of research that goes into finding these little nuggets, isn't there?
Well, with the bulletproof vest, that was the useful sort of Boy Scout thing that anyone should know who has a bulletproof vest. And indeed, I was running around in that.
Were you an Eagle Scout?
No, I only made it up to second class. Well, so I had to keep working away. But, you know, with the other thing you mentioned, thank God for Doe Library over at Berkeley. I just love going into the stacks of that place, and I can look up folklore on Serbian customs, or I can look at medieval grimoires with all kinds of magic spells, whatever I want. I mean, that is one of my favorite places.
Well, because you don't use the internet, you're obliged to go over to Berkeley. Can you have anything in Sacramento in the way of the sort of library resources that you're talking about?
The public library in Sac is not bad. They still have the Great Soviet Encyclopedia. I'm surprised they haven't sold that at a yard sale or something. But that's, I don't know, 20 or 30 volumes. And I always love pulling that thing out and reading their take on altruism or the Imperial Valley. It's just so different from anything I could dream up.
I was reading somewhere where you were doing translations of Norwegian. How many languages do you know?
Well, let's see. I can read and speak a little French and German and minimal Russian. It's almost gone now. But I always admired what Ezra Pound did with his translations, where all he would have would be a grammar and a dictionary. And I love the poetic Edda, the source, the major source of Norse myths. So I did some woodblock prints to illustrate some verses and translated some verses with the Pound method. And I enjoyed the process, even though it took an insane amount of time.
Love Pound for his method, maybe for his poetry, not for his politics.
His politics are quite unfortunate.
Good to have you with us. Really
well,
appreciate
you so
your
much.
Being. Last Stories and Other Stories is William T. Volman's new book. He is the author also of Europe Central, which won the National Book Award. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and we get online support from David Mark. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns, Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley-Ma, Charlie Zaharoff, Eric Nygaard, and Kaylin Dakin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.